So the first topic is Shabbat. And you know, Nebuch means woe unto me. Three yeshiva boys were caught playing cards for money on Shabbat in the yeshiva. So the first boy comes in to see the head of the yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva, and he's crying bitterly. He says, Rebbe, you have to forgive me. He says, I should forgive you for playing cards on Shabbat? For money? He says, Rebbe, you have to believe me. I forgot that it was Shabbat. He says, you forgot it was Shabbos? He says, absolutely. He says, okay. You go to the Beis Medrash, the house of study, and you'll say the entire book of Psalms, and you'll give charity, and you'll be forgiven. The next student comes in, and he's crying, Rebbe, you have to forgive me. I should forgive you for playing cards and Shabbat for money. He says, believe me, I forgot that you're not allowed to play cards for money on Shabbat. He says, you forgot that you're not allowed to play cards for money on Shabbat? Absolutely. He says, okay, go to the Beis Medrash, say the entire 150 Psalms and give charity, you'll be forgiven. The third fellow comes in, the Rebbe looks up and he says, what did you forget? He says, I forgot to pull down the shades so I wouldn't get caught. You got that one? I'll explain it to you later. A similar story. Rav Levi Yitzchak Abridichev was known as the Ohev Yisrael. He was a very famous Hasidic rabbi who loved all Jews. And they could never, ever get him to say a bad word about the Jewish people. In fact, there's a verse in the book of Isaiah, the first chapter, and it says, Banim gidalti v'romamti v'hem pashuvi. I raised children, I nurtured them, and they sinned against me. So how could you find something good about the Jewish people with that verse? So Rav Levi Yitzchak Abridichev says, you have to read it differently, you have to read it as a question. I raised children and nurtured them, v'hem pashuvi, and they sinned against me. Can it be possible? Of course not, it's not possible. That's the way he used to always find Zuchut, a merit for the Jewish people. So one day he's walking in the street of Berdichev on Shabbos and he sees a young man smoking a cigarette on Shabbat. He walks up to the young man and he says, gently, he says to the young man, young man, apparently you've forgotten that today is Shabbat. So the fella gives him a look with disdain and he says, no, Rabbi, I haven't forgotten that today is Shabbat. So again, with great gentleness, Rav Levi Yitzchak Abridichev says to him, then perhaps you've forgotten that you're not allowed to smoke on Shabbat. So the fellow says, look, Rabbi, I know it's Shabbos. I know you're not allowed to smoke on Shabbos, and I'm smoking anyway. So as a last-ditch effort, the rabbi says to him, maybe you're sick, and the doctor has prescribed that you must smoke on Shabbos. So he says, look, Rabbi, I'm not sick. No doctor's prescribed that I have to smoke on Shabbos. I'm smoking anyway. So Rav Levi Yitzchak Abridichev looks up to heaven and he says, Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, look how wondrous your children are. Like they might smoke in Shabbat, on Shabbat, and defy you in your Torah. But look, they will not utter a word of falsehood out of their mouth. They told the whole truth. He didn't deny anything. So he saw something nice about the guy. And then there's the famous story of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Yehuda Nasi was the editor of the Mishnah. Around the year 100, 150, the situation had gotten so terrible with the Romans that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was afraid that the oral code would be forgotten. So he broke 1,000 years of Jewish tradition and wrote down the Mishnayot, the oral code. And that eventually became what's known as the Talmud, the Mishnah and the Gemara. Yehuda Nasi was a very regal personality, rather wealthy. He had a beautiful farm up north in Tzipori, where you can go see it now. They finished the excavations there. It's worth going to see the archaeological dig in Tzipori in the Upper Galilee. And he was very friendly with the Romans. Rav Yehuda Nasi was particularly friendly with a Roman by the name of Antoninus. The Talmud calls him Antoninus. I always think that he's Mark Anthony, But he's not Mark Anthony. He was another Roman. And it was Marcus Aurelius, if I'm not mistaken, who became the Caesar, that became the Roman emperor. In any case, on one occasion, Antoninus came to Palestine and he visited with his friend Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and he came for Shabbat. And he was up in Tzipori in the beautiful mansion up there, and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi served him a delicious Shabbos meal. And Antoninus was just smitten by one of the dishes, maybe it was the soup. And he says, can you give me the recipe so that when I go back to Rome, I can brew up this recipe. Gave him the recipe, went back to Rome. He had the royal chefs, the best royal chefs, choose the best ingredients. And they brewed it up, and it just didn't taste the same. So he got better chefs, maybe he beheaded the first ones, better ingredients, tried it again, and it still tasted flat. So he was very upset. He was sure that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was withholding an ingredient from him. Goes back to Palestine another occasion. He confronts his friend Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He says, you know, just because I'm not Jewish doesn't mean that you had to withhold an ingredient. What ingredient were you withholding that I wasn't able to have my royal chefs brew up this soup? He says, you're right. What you tasted in the soup in my house was Shabbat. You tasted the taste of Shabbat. And you can't replicate it unless you keep Shabbat. Now, I believe, and I hope I'll be able to convince you by the end of this session, that the world never needed Shabbat more than today, more than the 21st century. And if you want, we'll take a look at the text that we have here. Now remember, the Ten Commandments appears in the Bible how many times? Twice. Once in Exodus 20 and again in Deuteronomy 5. Now, last week we read the first commandment, or the first statement, and they're the same in Exodus and Deuteronomy. But here you'll see a profound difference. So let's just take a look at Exodus 20. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. So the rabbis say, what happens if you work for 6 days and you still got a mountain of work to do? So what do you mean? 6 days shalt thou work and do all thy labor. 6 days shall thou labor and do all thy work. First of all, there's a mitzvah to work. Okay? You shouldn't sit home and clip coupons. In fact, what the real Torah is really saying is that you should do some sort of manual labor. You'll see as we get further in the book of Leviticus, in the Torah reading, that people should really have like a garden, some sort of a green thumb, a connection to the earth. One of the travesties that we suffer from today is that people don't have a connection to the land. And that's why they take it for granted. That's why we have these environmental problems, because they don't respect the dignity of the land. In any case, 6 days shall thou labor and do all your work. First of all, you're supposed to do work. But what happens if Shabbos comes, 6:48, we're lighting candles, and I got a mountain of work to do? What's the answer? It should be in your eyes as if it's all done. When the candles are lit, you're supposed to feel Shabbat. It's all done. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath unto the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any manner of work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. Where's your wife? How come the wife isn't mentioned here? How come the wife isn't mentioned here? Because she has to prepare for Shabbos, she has to cook, she has to clean. Why isn't the wife mentioned here? Doesn't the wife have Shabbat? What's the answer? It's talking to the wife. It's addressed to the wife and the husband. It's talking to all Jewish people. 6 days out of labor, do all your work. And when Shabbos comes, you man, woman, child, daughter, son, should rest. So that you're supposed to rest. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Okay, so in Exodus, the reason for keeping Shabbat, Steve, is in Exodus. What's the reason? The last verse. What's the last verse? Why do you have to keep Shabbat? Not because he blessed it. Because God himself rested on the Shabbat. So just as God rested on the Shabbat, we're supposed to rest. So what is Shabbat? The reason for Shabbat? To be free from work. Just as God didn't work on the seventh day, we need to rest on the seventh day. Now let's see what Exodus, what Deuteronomy says. So here we are in Deuteronomy 5. Now, remember what it said here. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Remember the Sabbath day. All of a sudden, it changes the text. Instead of Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, it says Shamor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So we see there are two different versions, okay? Rabbis say that the fact that it says Zachor v'Shamor is the reason that we have two candles on Shabbat. One for remember, one for observe. And remembering is what we do Friday night when we make Kiddush. But we'll have to understand, how can there be two versions? We'll see in a moment. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. Very similar to Exodus. But the seventh day is the Sabbath unto the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any manner of work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor the stranger that is within thy gates, that the manservant, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou. And thou shalt remember that thou wast the servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God brought thee out thence by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. Okay? Now at the end of this little snippet, we're presented with another reason to observe the Sabbath. And what does it say here, Stephen? Why do we keep the Sabbath here? I'm picking on him. We were commanded, but why? What's the reason? Because God brought you out of Egypt. So now it's not because God rested on the seventh day, but because you were slaves in the land of Egypt and now you're free. So there's this element of freedom. There are two different reasons. One is that God rested. The second is freedom from slavery. Now, how can there be two versions of the Ten Commandments? How can there be? After all, after the second commandment, after the second set of commandments in Deuteronomy, it says these are the words that God spoke in the mountain out of the fire. If these are the words, then what were those words in Exodus? So what do we say on Friday night when you go to shul and they sing the song, Lecha Dodi Likrat Kala, right? So the first verse begins, Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad hishmianu elam yuchad, that God said both observe the Sabbath day and remember the Sabbath day, and one speech. Speaking simultaneously, he said them at the exact same time. In fact, the Midrash says that the Ten Commandments were translated into 70 languages so all the nations of the world could hear. Well, if God can speak 70 languages at the same time, then he can say two versions. Why does he say two versions? Why are there two versions? Because there are two messages. One message is that you should rest because God rested, and the second is that because you were slaves in the land of Egypt. If that's the case, then why didn't he combine it together? Why does he drive us crazy by having two versions? And people say, oh, that's a later version, this is an early version. The editors didn't do a good job of editing. Why? Because that's the way the Torah works. There are 13 principles, scientific, mathematical principles, by which the Torah is interpreted. And only if you have these words in different contexts can you learn lessons from them. So if you have similar phrases in different contexts, you can learn what's in the first context to the second context. That's the way it works. And you're supposed to struggle over it, because God doesn't give you the Torah on a silver platter, because you're supposed to struggle. Remember what we said last week. For Nakasha Startminish, you don't die from questions. In fact, the doubt is what makes us learn. Okay? Let's go further. Now, I was very fortunate to study in my rabbinical studies with one of the greatest teachers of the 20th century, and that was Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He was born in 1903, died in 1993. I had him in the early 70s. He was not a young man, okay? He was almost 70 years old. He was a very fierce, rigorous teacher. In the earlier years, if you had him in the 40s and the 50s, if you came unprepared to his class, he would throw you out, he would mock you. He was very, very, very tough. And he comes from a long line of great, great scholars called the Soloveitchik Brisk family. Brisk is the city in Russia, Poland. It switches back and forth, called Brest-Litovsk, where Menachem Begin came from. And His grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisk, was the chief rabbi of Brisk. But even going back, his ancestors were very, very great, great, great scholars. And it's one of the great dynasties in Jewish, noble dynasties in Jewish learning. But his grandfather revolutionized the study of Talmud. And this was really the late 1800s, the early 1900s, where he basically approached Talmud in a very, very scientific, rigorous scientific matter. And he came up with new theories that had never been disclosed before. So if you were fortunate to be accepted in his class, and I would say the classroom was probably up to the middle poles here, you know, and it was limited to about 60, 70 people, but about 100 people squeezed into it. In the middle of the class, there was one column where all the students like me, the better students, used to try to hide behind, you know, so he wouldn't call on you, because if he called on you, you know, you started trembling. So everybody started coming earlier and earlier to get that one seat behind the column. In any case, when he started teaching, he lived in Boston, and he used to travel into New York 3 or 4 days a week. He would stay over in the dormitory at Yeshiva University. He was the chief rabbi of Boston, and he would give his classes. And these classes were a work of art, really a work of art, because you were watching in front of you one of the great minds at work. And we were senior students. In order to get into that class, you had to be students, because first of all, half of the class was occupied with students who had already graduated. And they refused to go to work, so they used to arrange their work schedules so that they would be free until 2 o'clock. He used to hold class like 11 o'clock. And they were with him for 10, 15, sometimes even 20 years, just to be with him. So you had maybe 35 or 40 students that were able to get into his class. If you were fortunate to get into his class. And he expected a lot of you, and used to spend the rest of the day studying. Before 11 o'clock and after 1 o'clock, you would prepare for that class, for that two-hour class. And he used to spend 12, 14, 16 hours, you know, preparing for that class. He used to do it with a study partner so that you couldn't cheat, you know. So if you didn't know something clear, your study partner would check you on that, okay? So you come into the class and you've already been preparing, and all you're studying is like a little piece of Talmud, which is, you know, like a half a page one side. And, you know, the fateful words would come, you know, Buchval, read the Gemara. Oh God, you know. So you start stuttering and stammering and start reading it, but you know it cold. You know, first of all, you've studied the text, the commentaries, the super commentaries, all the references, the other Talmudic tests that have to do with it, so you know it cold. You didn't want to be caught off guard. And you read like 2, 3, 4 lines, and then he'd say, I have a question. What is this little nuance in this text here? What is it there for? You know, what does it mean? You're reading, you know, and you try to explain it to him, and he rejects it. And then some other students suggest something, you know, and the senior students suggest something, you know, he rejects it. And that's the way it goes. You're reading, you think you know it, and he shows you that you don't understand one thing. So you read 14, 20 lines. In 45 minutes, he's asked 100 questions. And your mind is like a pretzel. I mean, you say to yourself, I thought I knew it. How could it possibly be? Then he would put his hand in his head in his hand for about 5 or 10 minutes, and he would say, gentlemen, I'd like to suggest something. And what he basically did was insert concepts, 1 or 2 concepts, into the whole text and show how there's a dialectic taking place between these two concepts. And he would build on it and build on it. All these questions that he had, 100 questions, he would answer it in a snap, because everything suddenly all came into place. He was like building a castle. It was like so remarkable. You'd walk out of that class and you'd say, I just saw a genius at work. I saw an artist at work. I saw someone create the most beautiful, beautiful construction of an intellectual building. And I had the privilege of being there. It was like unbelievable. You'd walk out there euphoric. Now, in the late 1880s, there was a man by the name of Friedrich Engels. It might ring a bell. He was a collaborator with Marx on the Communist Manifesto. And Friedrich Engels, who was Jewish, wrote a book called The Dialectic of Nature. dialectic of nature. What's the dialectic of nature? Now listen to this. You and I and every person on the face of the earth, we walk the streets all day long. We see the sun, we see the moon, we see the trees, we see the flowers. We inhale, we exhale. And we're completely oblivious to this dialectic of nature that Friedrich Engels points out, that is so obvious. Like you come out of the Salavatia class and you say to yourself, why didn't I think of that? Those principles are so simple, they're so self-evident. Well, because your name isn't Salavatia, because you're not an incredible genius like that. The geniuses have the ability to see through everything and just see it. That's what Friedrich Engels said. Everything that moves or breathes in nature has an active state and a passive state. Think about it. There's a thesis and an antithesis. That's the dialectic of nature. The sun rises, the sun sets. The moon waxes, the moon wanes. The tide goes in, the tide goes out. Your eye opens, your eye closes. You inhale, you exhale. Your heart beats, your heart rests. A flower blossoms, a flower dies. Everything that moves or breathes has an active stage and a passive stage. We just don't see it. But it's so clear, it's so self-evident. But it just eludes us. We just don't see it. And it's so, so incredible. And that's what the Shabbat is. We need an active stage and a passive stage. We need a thesis and an antithesis. We need a day of rest to compensate for the days of work. We need to sleep at night in order to compensate for the energy that we exerted during the day. Our heart needs to beat. Our heart needs to rest. We need to inhale. We need to exhale. In fact, some of the rabbis have said that's exactly the model of what Shabbat is. The circulatory and the respiratory system. He says, what happens? You inhale, and you inhale fresh air with oxygen. It enters through the lungs into the bloodstream. It oxygenates the cellular material. The cellular material exudes the deposits of waste, the carbon dioxide, and you exhale, you get rid of your waste, and then you inhale. And the heart beats and the heart rests. That's exactly what Shabbos is. Shabbos is the exhale where we get rid of, we eliminate the waste that have collected, the gook that has collected in our lives from the week. It's not enough to sleep at night. But you have collective waste that have gathered in your body, in your mind, in your spirit, in your soul that you have to get rid of. What are these collective wastes that we're talking about? Now listen to this. This is also quite remarkable. For the past couple of weeks, we've been reading in the Torah, not last week, but before that, for 5 weeks, we're reading in the Torah about the building of the tabernacle. That's the portable temple that the Jewish people carried with them as they traveled through the wilderness for 40 years. And it tells you all sorts of labors that are involved in the building of the tabernacle. And the Bible says, V'asuli mikdash v'shachanti v'tocham, and you shall build for me a sanctuary and I will dwell among them. God doesn't dwell in the sanctuary. It's a way of focusing the Jewish perspective, the Jewish souls, into God. The divine presence is now hovering over the people of Israel. So you're going to build a tabernacle to God. Who is God? God is omniscient. God is omnipresent. God is perfect. Well, if I'm going to build a tabernacle to God, a dwelling place, not for God, but for God's presence to be emphasized, then the tabernacle has to be perfect. So the tabernacle was an attempt to build perfection. To build perfection. That's what was involved in the building of the tabernacle. Now I ask you, what is the source of human creativity? Why do people create? Why was there a Picasso who created a whole new style of art? Who invented the wheel? What motivated that person to invent the wheel? Who invented the internal combustion engine? Why were there jet planes? Why are there rockets? Why are there speedier chips for the computer? Why? What leads a person to create, to invent? What do you say? What do you say? Okay, you say necessity is the mother of creation, of invention. What do you mean necessity? What does it mean? What causes people to be creative? What do you say? Nobody has any idea. Well, I don't know what to create. Yes?
To improve life.
If you want to improve life, that means what about life as it exists now? If you want to improve it, it means what? It's what? What does it mean? It could be better. It's not so good. It's not so good. I want to improve life. I have a perfectly beautiful house, a beautiful home that's beautifully furnished, but it's out of style. And I'm going to throw out perfectly good furniture because it's out of style. Because I'm not satisfied with it. Because it frustrates me that people are going to come into my house and say, "Ooh, this guy is not in tune with the times." Okay? I want to improve on the horse and buggy because it doesn't go fast enough. So I have the steam engine. Or I have a boat. And then the automobile. And then the jet. And then the rocket. I want to go faster. I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated because it's not going faster. I want more money. More money. Because I don't have enough money in my bank account. I'm frustrated. I have to figure out a way to earn more money. So what is the source of creativity? Interestingly, the negative. It's the frustration. It's the dissatisfaction. It's the unhappiness that leads to so much creativity. Because you want it to be better. I need an incandescent bulb. I don't want this fire in my house. I don't want the smoke. I want a fluorescent. I want track lighting. Fancier, better. I'm unhappy. Frustration is the source of so much creativity. That's the gook that collects in you during the week. From creativity, that's the gook, that's the waste, that's the frustration that's there. And you can't get rid of it. That's why you need Shabbat. You need Shabbat to air it out, to empty it out. The tabernacle was an attempt to create the most perfect dwelling place on the face of the earth. The 39 different types of work that were involved in the building of the tabernacle was the source of all creativity. It doesn't say, by the way, in the Bible, don't do any work on Shabbat. It says, lo ta'aseh chol melacha. Don't do any creative labor. There's a difference between avodah, which means labor, work, and melacha. Melacha is creative. It's like the word malach, like an angel. It's something ethereal. And those 39 categories of work that are divided up into weaving, planting, tanning, making fire, carrying, and writing are the definition of what work is in the Bible. That's what work is. The Jewish definition, the physicist has his definition of work. If I move this Zucker box a certain distance, so its mass times distance is work. The physicist, I've done work. If I've moved this a certain distance, I've done work. But according to the physicist, if I do isometric exercises, I push against the wall for half an hour, I'm sweaty, I'm fatigued, I haven't moved anything, right? I haven't done any work, according to the physicist, because I haven't moved anything. And that's true in Shabbat as well. I can move around all the furniture in my house on Shabbat, from one room to the next if I need room for a table to welcome my guests on Shabbat. And I haven't done any work. If I carry a feather outside where there's no Erev, where there's no construction to allow you to carry in the public domain, I violated the Shabbat. I've done work. It's not because it's hard, not because it's arduous, not because it's tiring. It's because that's the definition. The ability or the attempt to create the most perfect dwelling place is what defines for us what work is. So you say to me, Buchwald, I know all about this business. I know you're not allowed to work on Shabbat and stuff like that. He says, but I know how to get around it. I know how to get around it. For instance, I can take a Shabbos clock, a time clock, plug it into my VCR, plug it into my disc player, and I can watch a beautiful television show on Shabbat. Why not? Sit with my children. It could be so beautiful. It could be so much fun. Or, better yet, I can play tennis on Shabbat. Oh, no, you can't play tennis on Shabbat. Why can't you play tennis? First of all, you can't carry. Don't worry. I have a tennis court that has an Erev around it, so you're allowed to carry there. Oh, the tennis racket is muktzah. Muktzah means that you're not allowed to use things on Shabbat that have no use on Shabbat. That's why money, you're not allowed to touch money on Shabbat because you have no use for it. You're not allowed to do business. There's nothing wrong with money on Shabbat, but it's going to lead you to... So, muktzah is something, that you're not allowed to use on Shabbat. So tennis racket is, you don't use it on Shabbat. A tennis ball is muktzah. A hammer is muktzah. But if you're going to use the hammer to crack nuts on Shabbos, then it's not muktzah, because you're doing a permitted, something that's permitted. So he says, Rabbi, listen, I know how to do it. I'm going to buy a special Shabbat tennis racket. In fact, I'm going to buy a Spalding tennis racket that has an S on it, so I'll know it's for Shabbat. And I will be inside my enclosed tennis court, so I'm allowed to carry there. And this is the only tennis racket that I use on Shabbat, and the tennis balls will be Shabbat tennis balls, and we'll have a great set of tennis. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? I haven't violated anything. None of the 39 categories of work, of labor. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is very interesting. So you could say, one of the reasons that they say is not in the spirit of Shabbos. That's not what you're supposed to do on Shabbos. You're supposed to learn Torah, you're supposed to go to the synagogue, you're supposed to have meaningful conversations, you're supposed to do acts of kindness on Shabbat. That's not within the spirit. Who has to watch, Mary Tyler Moore, who has to watch Madonna on Shabbos, That's not what Shabbos is all about. Who wants to play a tennis racket, tennis game on Shabbat? That's one thing. But even more than that is this, and this is really what's spectacular about Shabbat. Let's say you were playing a game of tennis, and you're playing against or with even your own child, a 4-year-old child, 5-year-old child, that wasn't especially talented yet. Maybe they would grow up to be Wimbledon champs. But right now, they're just learning how to hold the racket. And you're volleying the ball toward them, and the likelihood is that they're going to miss every single ball. That means you're going to be chasing after 10, 20, 30, 40 balls, unless you have a lot of balls there, okay? Or you have a ball boy who's running after them for you, okay? But after about 5 minutes, you're going to be fatigued, you're going to be worn out, you're going to be frustrated. And unless that person can hit the ball back to you, then you aren't really going to be happy with that tennis game, with that tennis set. Which means that the only reason that you're playing tennis is because you have a utilitarian value that the other person gives to you. The only reason I'm playing is because you can hit the ball back. If you can't hit the ball back to me, then I have no use for you. Unless you're a tennis pro and you're being paid $150 an hour to teach this little kid. Then, makes a difference. On Shabbat, it has nothing to do with the next person's utilitarian value. I want to be with you because I want to be with you. Not because you can sing well, not because you can dance well, not because you can play well. Not because you and I can laugh at Barbara Streisand on the television. I don't need a third person to entertain me. I want you to entertain me. I want you to talk to me. I want you to look into my eyes. I want to be able to put my hands on top of your head and bless you on Friday night to my children. I want to see that you really have blue eyes. I haven't looked in your face in so long. We don't have that luxury anymore. That's what Shabbat is about. Shabbos is about going to the primordial element of the human being to say, I want to be human. We've lost our humanity. We've lost our humanity. And in this high-tech world, it's gotten even worse. It's gotten so worse. I live across the street from Riverside Park. And I am, I'll admit it, a bit of a voyeur. So I look out the park. I see who's going into the park. You know, I see the couples, lovey-dovey, you know, walking into the park. I noticed something very interesting about 25 years ago. The couple started walking into the park when they had, you know, a cassette Walkman. They started walking into the park with Walkman, you know, the Walkman. If they were really in love, they were plugged into the same Walkman. If they weren't so much in love, they were listening to separate programs. They had separate earphones. Today you have your iPod, right? So they're walking in with iPods. They're going to meet each other, to talk to one another. No, they're listening to programs. Some of them are even watching television. I mean, they're watching movies. This is a date. They don't talk to one another. No wonder people can live with each other for 8 years and then get divorced after 2 months of marriage because they've never spoken to each other. They don't have the opportunity. It's so tragic. It's really so tragic. The average parent speaks to their child today no more than 12 minutes a day. And most of that speech has to do with, did you make your bed? Did you do your homework? Did you wash behind your ears? Etc., etc. And the average family watches 49 hours of television a week. Is that a tragedy? Is that a tragedy? And today we're all wired. We're all hooked in. It's like incredible. You don't have a moment of privacy. You know that guy, you know, guy goes into the bathroom to relieve himself. He's sitting on the toilet and he hears, you know, a guy in the next booth say, hi, Joe, how are you? His name is Joe. He says, I'm fine. So the guy on the next booth says, listen, Joe, I'm going to have to call you back because there's some jerk in the next booth who thinks I'm talking to him. So he's sitting on the toilet on the cell phone. You don't have a moment. You can't urinate without the cell phone. You have to jump up and down. I ask you, if someone came to your house every hour, 5 times an hour, and knocked on the door and says, it's me, it's Sam, or it's Joe, you know, oh, it's Sarah, you know, it's Sally, you know, 5 times an hour, came to your door, you know, maybe even the same person over and over. Wouldn't you say it's a little excessive? But isn't that what we do? We rack up. Minutes on the cell phone, you get an idea. And remember, we're not even counting the free weekend and night minutes, okay? But people are buying 4,000, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 minutes. And you know how many phone calls that means? It's buzzing, 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 buzzing. You don't have a life. You really don't have a life. It's taken. And now, it's not enough to have the cell phone. You have to have text messaging, right? And you have to have your BlackBerry. And what happens, you know, and you're away on vacation and your BlackBerry is there. There is no sacred time. That's what Shabbat is all about. And how do I know that it's good? How do I know that it's good? How do I know that it's holy? Well, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, we made the big times. Here it is, March 2nd, 2008. The Holy New York Times has an article that says, I need a virtual break. No, really, where a guy says, he's a technical writer for the New York Times, he says, I took a real day off this weekend. Computers shut down, cell phone left in my work bag, landline ringer off. I was fully disconnected for 24 hours. That people are starting to unplug. We're starting to unplug. Otherwise, you can't live. Melust nicht leben. They don't let you live. We're like zombies, automatons. It's so unbelievably frustrating. We don't talk to one another anymore. We really don't. That's what the soundbite generation is all about. That's what the MTV generation is all about. That if someone says more than 15 words to you, then it's overload. I can't handle it anymore. You don't have a meaningful conversation. And let me tell you something. When you're talking with your child or with your spouse, and all of a sudden your cell phone rings, and you answer it, and it's probably AT&T or T-Mobile or Verizon trying to sign you up for a longer contract, aren't you saying to your child or your spouse that whoever is that stranger on the other side of the phone is more important than you? Isn't it a put-down? It's such a terrible and incredible put-down. We need to go back to nature. We have to have a non-utilitarian agenda. And let me tell you something. With the prices that therapists are charging today, you know, $300, $400, $500 an hour, 25 hours of Shabbos therapy is really cheap. It's like getting away with murder. And it really does return you to yourself. You can focus on yourself. You can focus on your family. You can focus on meaningful things. You can read a book. Whoever reads books today? Nobody reads books. Shabbat provides intimacy. It's what William Wordsworth wrote. The world is too much with us. He wrote that in 1807. And that was before cell phones. I mean, can you imagine? I can't imagine. You know, I can't imagine. If I had to answer the messages on Shabbat that I have to answer on Thursday and Friday and Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, I would give up. I really would give up. I mean, I carry a wad of messages, or I carry, you know, a whole list of the people that called me that I have to... There's really no time to live. There's no time to live. And we need sacred time. And you can't have quality time without quantity time. It is such a fraud to say, oh, we have quality time with our children. She's a doctor, he's a lawyer. They decide that 6 o'clock on Thursday night, they're going to come home for 2 hours to play with their children. She has an emergency in the hospital. He has an emergency in the office. They come running home out of breath, you know, till they catch their breath. It takes half an hour. They have to get a cup of coffee or something, you know, just to settle down. And then they have to figure out what they're going to do for the next hour and a half until they come up with that. You have 15 minutes left of quality time with your children. It's a fraud. But that's why Shabbat is so, so important, because you have mandated quality time. And the TV's off, and the VCR's off, and the internet is off, and the BlackBerry's off. And you're saying to the telephone, drop dead. You can't violate my time and my space. Drop dead. And if there are emergencies, the emergencies always can be managed. And not only that, but you have mandated meals, 3 mandated meals in Shabbat. You know, most people don't have any meals together as families. Very, very rare. You'll see in the next lecture how much the frozen food market is, because people don't have mandated meals. They don't have meals together. And that children make 80% of their meals today by putting it into the microwave. I mean, it's such a tragedy. We're destroying our world. Then you want to know why there's such a mess out there. The New York Times reported that infants are now watching DVDs in their cribs. Infants are now watching DVDs in their cribs. The Jewish people sanctify time. Time is the most valuable commodity that you have in your life. Yeah, we have a holy spot in Jerusalem. We have the Western Wall. And we have nice temples and nice synagogues. But it's not space that's sanctified. Killing time is like killing life. And unless you find that treasure, the treasure of time, then your life is going to be fleeting right by you. It's the great... You know, if I had an opportunity, I would go down to Washington. I'd say to Mr. Bush, you want to address 85% of the problems that afflict our country, drugs, violence, whatever it is. You know what you should do? This is tongue-in-cheek. You should go to Congress and get them to legislate Shabbat. Friday for the Muslims, Saturday for the Jews, Sunday for the Christians. Because you need sacred time. and people are no longer people. You're not a mensch. You may be a homo sapien, but you're not a mensch. You're not a human being. You don't know how to talk. You don't know how to listen. People don't know how to listen. People don't listen. And that's why our Torah says, Zachor v'shamor, remember the Sabbath day and observe the Sabbath day. Because we need both elements. We need physical rest from labor. We need physical rest. You need a day of Shabbat. You need 25 hours of rest. But you also need liberation. You need to liberate yourself. You have to get rid of those wastes. You have to be able to establish relationships, human relationships. People don't have human relationships today. You live in a high-rise tower building where there may be 30 apartments on your floor and you don't know who your next-door neighbor is. The next-door neighbor died 6 months ago and nobody knew that she died until the body started smelling up the whole hallway. I mean, it's such a tragedy. We're not equipped to live like ants in a molehill. It's overload. It's overload. You need to stop, to slow down, to smell the roses. And here it is. 25 hours of therapy, free. So we have both elements, both the rest and the freedom. You know, the Torah says, "Mechalaleha mot yumat." Those who desecrate the Sabbath shall surely die. In ancient times, you know, someone violated the Sabbath with the proper witnesses. Very, very unlikely and unusual, they could actually be put to death. But what does that mean to us today? We say that all the verses of the Bible are immortal. They mean something to those who violate the Sabbath. I see these Jewish people running back and forth to the supermarket, to the beauty parlor, to the gym, and I say, you're giving up the greatest treasure, you know, to buy a bottle of milk. I mean, you know, Esau gave up his birthright. At least he gave it up for a bunch of lentils. At least he got something good to eat, you know. But to give it up, you know, to get your hair colored or your hair styled, you know, or, you know, to work out for 2 more minutes, you know, on the treadmill. For what? You could do that on Thursday and Friday after Shabbos. Mechalel mot yumat. We're killing ourselves. We're really killing ourselves. You know, there's there was a famous rabbi of Nikolsburg, Rav Shmulka. He died in 1778. And he was considered a great, great scholar, and he was considered a very pious and generous person. So the poor people used to come to him all the time. And one day, after he was hit by a lot of poor people, a poor person came to him and he had no money in his pocket. And he just couldn't live with himself. So he had the poor person walk him home and had him wait. And he goes to his wife's jewelry box and he takes out a little brooch, a little pin. And he says, take this. You'll bring it to the market. You'll get money for it. He thought it wasn't valuable. After the poor person left, his wife comes in. She sees the jewelry box open. She says, where's my brooch? He says, I just gave it to the poor person. She says, don't you realize that there was a valuable stone in that brooch? You have no idea how valuable it was. He starts running out, chasing after the poor person. The poor person sees him chasing after him. He starts running faster. And he couldn't catch up with him. So finally, before he left out of earshot, he screams out to the poor person, Rabbi Yid, Rabbi Yid, Mr. Jew, Mr. Jew, I don't want the brooch back. I just want to tell you that there's a very valuable jewel in that brooch. And when you sell it in the marketplace, you should get the full value and not be cheated. I want you to know that we've all been given a very, very valuable jewel. And that's Shabbos. You have no idea of its infinite value. Don't sell it short. Don't give it away. It is a taste of the world to come. It is an opportunity to regain hold of your life. Don't give it away. Try it, even for a few hours. Try it. You'll see It will change your destiny. It will change your family. It will change your mind. It will change who you are. You will become better. Your environment will become better. The world will become better. So I wish you all Shabbat Shalom. May we all have a Sabbath of peace and holiness. If you have any questions, you can ask me. Okay? And we will continue with the second session on Jewish observances in just 5 minutes. Okay? Oh, we did that pretty fast, I gotta tell you. All right.
Refreshments downstairs.
Refreshments downstairs on the house.